the women, we can share the wine. We can share what we got of yours, cause we done shared all of mine. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Thanks to both Lizzie Honan and Sarah Gilbert for joining us this morning and talking about the importance of the fund drive. WAMC.org, if you'd like to help now with the lockbox, WAMC.org. We'd love to have you on board as early as possible. And again, we thank them for giving us an idea of the road ahead, which is an important one, and we thank you and thank them for everything. So now we start off with our panel. We have a wonderful group this morning. Let me introduce them to you real quick. I just want to mention that the music we'll be hearing going into our breaks is that of Bob Weir. We lost Bob Weir over the weekend. He was born in 1947 and died this year. And just over the weekend, and very sad, and we'll be playing Bob Weir music throughout this morning. And I know I was reading some of the obituaries and what a filled life, yeah. And a lot going on, and great success, obviously, with the Grateful Dead and others. An incredible performer, and we'll be offering a tribute this morning. Let me introduce the group to you. Founder and Academic Director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and Professor of Politics, Philosophy, and Human Rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz. Roger, good morning. How are you?
Happy New Year. It's good to be here, Joe.
Really good to have you here. Happy New Year to you as well. Libby Post joins us, political consultant and lobbyist. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm fine. Oh, it was a good weekend of football.
Yes.
I have to say
I'm sorry.
I became quite enamored by all of the games and how exciting they were. So I'm watching the games and I'm thinking, yeah, this is really cool. You know, like these are the best seats in the house. And then I look on my Facebook page, this one, Libby, this one, watching the Bills game with the governor.
And Paul Tonko. And a host of friends. Like, the place was packed, but it really was a lot of fun.
She had her jersey on.
She had, my business partner, Sheila, said, she's got Bill stuff on her feet, you know? So she was decked out in Bill's gear, which is the way it should be. And I'm very sorry that the Eagles lost.
Oh, I don't care about the Eagles.
Oh, you don't?
Oh,
you
no,
just
no.
only care about the Phillies?
I care about the Phillies.
Oh, okay. I said to Lynn, you're going to be so upset when
I've
I came
always
in this morning.
I've always thought that the, I can't say the word on the air, but I've always thought that the Eagles were kind of jerks.
Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
So
no,
then
I was very
sorry.
Pleased. I was very pleased that the Bills won.
Yeah, that was
I was
a
very
great
pleased
game.
That the Pats won.
The Bills game was really great.
I was very happy that the 49ers won. I thought that was very cool.
Right. I always like when San Francisco wins, just from the gay perspective. You know what I mean?
I can understand.
Yes.
So an amazing – although and God love Chicago. That Chicago Bears game was one of the best football games I've seen ever.
I didn't watch
it was,
that.
Oh, God. The last few minutes of that was just stunning. Absolutely stunning. One more tonight, and then we go into the playoff.
Well, the last few minutes of the Bills games was kind
of all of them.
Yeah.
It was just like they're stunning.
It all came down to the fourth quarter.
Great.
Yeah.
The Super Bowl has a lot to answer for because they're going to have a trouble meeting any of those playoff teams.
Right. And the thing is that many times when we get to the Super Bowl, it is boring.
Yeah.
It's just boring. And it's like, come on.
Nothing boring about this weekend. Yeah. Very, very exciting.
It was great.
Catherine Tan is with us, Associate Professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College. Good morning, Catherine. A delight to have you with us.
Good morning. I did not watch the game yesterday, but you know what I did do? I went to see professional bull riding at Madison Square Garden.
Okay. So,
Kidoki.
All right. Now, I have so many questions.
I did too going in.
How did you fall into that?
Oh, so this was my first time attending, and friends from the farm where I ride, not bulls, I ride horses.
Yeah.
But they invited me and I went. And it was delightful. And so you're supposed to stay on for 8 seconds.
8 seconds, right.
Which, you know, now, at first I heard, I'm like, 8 seconds, that's not very long at all. And then you see these guys go, and you're like, no, this is eternity. it's wild. Because a lot of people will fall off, like, sometimes within a second. Sure. But it's incredibly impressive and super fun.
And nobody got hurt.
No, that's not true. One person definitely got hurt.
Okay. That's good. I like the clowns. I like the people who start running out when somebody goes off.
Yes, and I was told there would be a very funny clown, but he retired in 2024, so we didn't zero clowns this time.
Really?
Yeah, zero clowns.
They couldn't find another clown?
Couldn't find another clown. No one's going into the clown business.
They didn't
anymore.
Want to take the Amtrak.
God, we could send them a
They couldn't get the right schedule for Amtrak.
Send them a list,
right.
Goodness sakes.
Right.
Well, that's great. And was this a championship or a...
Yeah, something like that.
Oh, good. Well, that's really exciting.
I don't really know the circuit very well, but it was a lot of fun.
The PBA, the Professional Bull Riders Association.
PBR. Oh, yes, PBR.
Yeah, PBR is... Perhaps Blue Ribbon, I
yes.
believe. Yeah, okay. closely associated to pro bull riding, we should mention. Catherine, a delight to have you here. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we will get started now with the stories of the day. A lot going on. I think that I would like to start... the two big stories, I think, that broke in the last 12 hours, not one that has been ongoing, but we learned late yesterday of the investigation into Jerome Powell, who is being investigated. Obviously, the Trump administration has wanted this guy out for a long, long time. He's leaving very soon, but still... an investigation is in the works as we speak. So we'll put that story on hold for just a minute and talk about what is happening in Iran as military strikes are considered. The Trump administration national security officials are preparing to meet on potential responses, including a range of military options. Hundreds of demonstrators have been killed in Iran, rights groups said this morning, as reports of dramatic escalation and the use of deadly force by security forces begin to break through a communications blackout imposed by authorities struggling to contain some of the largest protests since the Islamic Republic was founded in 1979. Trump administration national security officials, meanwhile, were preparing to discuss options, including possible military strikes, according to a senior U.S. official speaking to the Washington Post. The Center for Human Rights in Iran, based in New York, said it had received eyewitness accounts and credible reports that hundreds of protesters have been killed since the government shut down access to the internet Thursday night. The Human Rights Activist News Agency, also based in the United States, said 490 protesters had been killed since the protests began December 28th. A senior Western official who was briefed on the matter said hundreds were killed in 48 hours of protests. The official who spoke on the condition of anonymity because he was not authorized to brief the media said the spread of protests across a wide geographical area made it difficult to gather credible casualty figures. We do know, however, that it is a very tense situation in that region, and what is going on as the death toll surges in Iran. And leaders are taking a very tough line against protesters. Libby Post.
You know, it's so duplicitous. I have to say, here we are shooting and ICE shooting and killing American citizens randomly based on what they consider to be threats when someone's driving away from them and not towards them. And then, you know, branding these folks as domestic terrorists when she was just dropping her kid off at school.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, see ya, right? And he has to shoot her and kill her. And it's just astounding. And yet we're have this unbelievable umbrage that, you know, Iran is going after the people who are working for pro-democracy or whatever it is they want to do in Iran to open up that society and that their politics. It's just, it's this cognitive dissonance. I don't know mm-hmm. what to call it, but it's like, the other part of this is, folks, Jeffrey Epstein. Look, there are all these things going on the world stage. We've taken over Venezuela. We might bomb Iran, right? We might take over Cuba. So nobody's paying attention because Trump and his minions do not want you to pay attention to Jeffrey Epstein and what those files say.
I would argue it's hard to pay attention to anything because there's so much going
on. Well, there is that. I mean, they're constantly barraging us with something new all the time so that we just tune it out.
Yeah, this has been the strategy since even the first Trump administration, right? Just distract people so that you can't spend even like 5 minutes on any particular issue. And with this one, I mean, I completely agree. It is really, I mean, there's a kind of irony here in which, you know, Trump is saying, what do you say? Iran is looking at freedom, perhaps like never before. And he thinks that we're going to, you know, come in and do something to help these people. You know, these are people who are protesting against, you know, initially it started off as expressing outrage about inflation and the economy. And now it is a larger conversation about the government and their political system. And ironically, you know, like people in the United States, these are our issues too. And what is Trump doing about that, right? What happened to America first, right? What happened to dealing with domestic issues? Meanwhile, he's turning his eye towards all these other countries while people are still struggling with affordability mm-hmm. and ICE shooting citizens. It's wild.
It is wild. It's so typical of somebody who just can't focus on one thing at once, which he can't, right? And just the whole administration is propping this man up so that none of them have to deal with the story that's right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
The millions of pages that mm-hmm. are being gone through on the Jeffrey Epstein case.
What is it, like 2 million new documents or something released recently?
Trump is in there. We know he is a convicted sexual abuser. Mm-hmm. He's a convicted felon. And if you are willing to dismiss that and Jeffrey Epstein, then you're getting what you deserve, which is a dysfunctional government that is just looking at anything else and bombing. They're so into it. It's like boys in their toys. They are so into like threatening and bombing and doing this and using our military, and we have the best military in the world. I invested all this money in the military, blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, firing really competent trans military people because they don't like the fact that they're transgender. I mean, it's just, it's an absurdity that we're living through. The problem is it's got very real-world consequences.
Yeah.
And all of us can be impacted by it.
Yeah, what's the deal with bringing in like violence to bring about peace?
Right.
It's nonsense.
Well, I remember Reagan's peace through strength.
Yes, and again, I mean, this is all while at every turn and every speech he said, "I'm a president who is ending wars, not starting wars."
Right,
Roger.
So, I mean, I wrote a column this week about how dangerous things are right now domestically, and I'm certainly no fan of many of the ways that the president does things, but I find myself sort of in shock and very much opposed to what's been said so far. First of all, just one or two facts. I mean, He's not a convicted sex felon. He was found in a civil case. He was found to have.
Well, that's good enough for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just want to be. As
women,
I'm
sorry, Roger.
I just like to be factual.
That's good enough for us.
I just like to be factual about things, and he's not convicted of that. I think he is a sex predator. I'm just saying he wasn't convicted. I think we should be accurate. You know, this is a situation. I mean, I think to understand what's going on in Iran, you have to look at his larger foreign policy, which the last 10 days has given a huge insight into. But let's just remember the regime in Iran is an evil regime, and it's to compare it to ours even at this point is I think senseless. And secondly, it's one that is profoundly dangerous to our interests. And there is, I don't know exactly how much to credit the opposition there. I don't know how big the rallies really are. I don't know how endangered the regime really is. But I think Trump's foreign policy has made it clear that he's going to use opportunities when they arise to pursue U.S. interests and take on the countries that oppose us when he thinks they can do so in a way that is not going to cost too much to the United States. And sort of what he did in Venezuela, and I think he's looking at it in Iran. I don't know what he's going to do. I don't have enough information or really thoughts about whether he should or not. But you know, we have in the past encouraged the Iranian people to rebel against their regime and then abandon them. And people have criticized presidents who have done that. If he does that again, if he says we're going to help them and then doesn't, I think he'll be open to that criticism again. But I think it is important to remember that Iran is both a morally and politically dangerous regime. And if he thinks he has a low cost in the sense of it won't cost us too much in our interests way of pushing that regime out or weakening that regime, I do think that helps the world.
I'm interested in how we measure that in the sense of even Venezuela.
Yeah.
We don't really know yet, do we?
Don't.
I mean, we have no idea what that's going to, what could extrapolate from that action.
We actually don't, and I think that's a good point. But you can see the strategy, right? Whether the strategy
yes.
works or not is unclear. Unlike going into Iraq and trying to own the country and getting caught in a cesspool for many years,
right.
And unlike taking out Gaddafi in Libya and then basically letting the country descend into a human rights chaos while we did nothing, there's an attempt to create what's sort of a middle road path in Venezuela, where you take out a corrupt and criminal leader, and who's destroyed the country, and you say, all right, we're not going to go in. We're not going to get caught in the Iraq, but we're not going to just leave and let it do nothing like we did in Libya. We're going to use threats and power to force and cajole the people in Venezuela to try and restore the economy, restore the country, and improve the lives of their people and enrich my friends who are going to invest in the oil. Whether that will work, I mean, I think it's an interesting plan. These things always work better in theory than they do in practice, and there's no doubt in my mind that there are interests in Venezuela that will seek to disrupt what the president and his administration is trying to do, and there are interests in China and Russia and even in Iran that will do so. And so I have no idea if it will work, Joe. I mean, and I think it's way too early to tell. All I'm saying is if you look at it from a foreign policy point of view, there's a plan there. Most of our plans in the last 20 years in foreign policy have failed, whether it's in Iraq or Libya or anywhere else. Whether this one will succeed, I have no idea. But I at least see the plan, and I see it an attempt to react to the failures of other plans.
Anyone else?
I don't know if there's much of a plan in place here. Like with Venezuela, like Trump is just has dropped all pretenses about protecting the United States from drug imports. Even starting with that, most of our, the illegal drugs coming in are not coming in through Venezuela. But aside from that, those pretenses have been dropped. And now it's flatly about oil, right? And securing access to oil. So I don't know if there's any real interest in helping, Venezuelans or their political system. And with Iran, I don't think there's much of a plan in place here. I think a lot of it is optics. To Libby's point, I think it's also greater, more distraction. I don't think he really has any sort of real political strategy behind this.
So I don't know why you think they dropped the pretenses of drugs. I mean, every time he talks about it, he says that the reason we went in was for drugs and security. He says the oil is a good side benefit. Whether you agree with him or not, the pretense is there. I'm not saying it, I have no idea what his actual view are.
The rational journalism that I've read, like the New York Times, has been clear that the drugs are not Venezuela's issue. They're not exporting drugs to the United States like Colombia.
Yeah.
Okay, like some
it's mostly
other
coming
places.
Through Colombia and Mexico.
Right.
Well, he's threatening Colombia and Mexico too.
But he made it very clear that this is about oil. This is about taking back the infrastructure that we built, which is really, Exxon and all the oil companies built there and then it was nationalized. And so this is about money. This is about lining the coffers and the pockets of the people who support him and who he wants their support.
I think if you listen to the New York Times interview and you read the interview, he said it very clearly. The main two reasons were the insecurity around drugs and the insecurity around immigration of people who are fleeing Venezuela because it's a horrific place to live. And he said, oil was something we want to add to that and we want to help rebuild their economy, make their lives better. And he's clear he
That's
wants to make America richer.
What he said.
Well, first of all, I was simply saying the pretense is not dropped. It's there. And I think he's also interested in going after Mexico and Colombia and other places, or at least dealing with it. And I think that to simply deny that that's part of what he's after, I think, is a mistake in understanding of what he's doing.
I also think, to an extent, this is also none of our business.
There is that.
Right? Even if it's, about rebuilding or, strengthening infrastructure over there, why is this our business? Why are we there? And same with the Iranian protesters. Raja, as you pointed out, you're like, well, this is Iran has a really dangerous regime and absolutely super oppressive. But I also think that the U.S. is on a similar track, right? In Iran, you have laws that are dictated by religion. And, we're seeing the right here in the United States imposing, their version of Christian values. Mm-hmm. We are not so unlike Iran, right? It's not a faraway world.
I have great worries about where we're headed.
Mm-hmm.
To say we are not so far from a murderous theocratic regime in Iran, I think is honestly makes no sense. I don't understand how you can say that. There's free speech here. There's free elections.
In theory.
No, we're not in theory. We're sitting here on the radio saying this stuff. I'm not worried about being arrested. I don't think there is any way to compare these things in a meaningful way that is not crazy. I'll be honest.
But it is. I don't want to simplify this too much, but it does seem that these warnings would perhaps are coming at a time are concerning more so because of what happened in Venezuela, because we are seeing a trend in a very short period of time. And as you mentioned, Roger, also with Colombia, Mexico, Cuba, and the list goes on. And by the way, the added benefit of Greenland.
Right. So I think this requires us to really understand that what we're seeing potentially, again, it's hard to know exactly what's happening because I don't think Trump is always clear or truthful in his statements. But if we start to try and piece things together, what we're seeing is a major realignment and rethinking of American foreign policy. You started to see it in the document that was produced in November, the new foreign policy document, or national security document. But what's clear is that the Trump administration is basically taking of the opinion that the liberal world order is over. The idea that we are a force for good in the world, which was, in all honesty, laughable to 80% of the world, but meaningful to us and some of our allies, is one that he no longer finds valuable. And he is, and you know, it's hard to know exactly what to call the new foreign policy, but it's a kind of neo-imperialism, in a sort of a Roman sense, not the sort of 18th, 19th century imperialism. It's instead of going in and occupying countries, it's going in and, in a sense, using your power to force countries to, in a sense, you know, comply with your will. That's what we're trying to do in Venezuela, without occupying them and running them ourselves. It's sort of the way the Romans dealt with their client states, as opposed to the way, you know, the English Empire or other empires did. And I think that's where we're headed. We are going to become. I mean, people have been saying, "Oh, we're an imperialist power for ages." We weren't. You know, we had there were things that we did that were bad, but you know, we weren't out and out an imperialist power. And to some extent, there's a kind of neo-imperialism in Trump that he says is, "Look, it's just honest. It's who we really have always wanted to be and needed to be." China's an imperialist power. Russia's an imperialist power. Iran's an imperialist power. And if we're going to compete on the world stage, we have to be. And whether this will succeed over a long term in the new as the U.S. foreign policy depends on how long Trump stays in power and how long people like him stay in power. But it is a shocking deviation from where we've been. And I think instead of just screaming about it and saying how evil it is, people need to start actually analyzing it and articulating its strengths and its weaknesses, and because it is now the U.S. foreign policy in some way.
We are late for a break, and we have letters. I have a huge follow-up question for you, so I'm going to hold that. We'll take a break. We'll step back, and then we'll return right after this short break.
What you are and what you're meant to be.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Playing the music of Bob Weir this morning, guitarist and founding member of the Grateful Dead, who died over the weekend at the age of 78. We will be honoring him with his music this morning. We have a lot of letters, and I want to get to those. Thank you, Roger. I said I had a big follow-up question, and that is, I mean, you're right. This is big change, right? This is huge. The UN, Europe, our allies are, and this is not a technical term, but are freaking out. So how do we deal with that in the sense of it seems in some ways that while I understand what you're saying and you make a compelling argument, we still have the rest of the world shaking its head going, what are y'all doing?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the end game?
Yeah. No, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the hardest things, you know, from my point of view in trying to think at some way sane and impartially about what's going on in the Trump administration is that to me there's a difference between what he's doing and how he's doing it. And it's in everything he does. I don't agree with everything he's doing, but I try and at least understand the arguments for what he's doing. And then there's the how he does it, which I find repulsive and dangerous and chaotic and deeply immoral, as well as just often tyrannical and authoritarian. So you know, so I understand why people are freaking out. And the question that you have to always separate, are they freaking out because of the what or the how? Now, sometimes both.
Right.
You know, on Greenland, right, you know, I mean, on Maduro, I think it's the how and not the what, right? I mean, I think not that many people are upset that Maduro's gone.
No.
I think people are upset at...
There was a great agreement that this was a really bad dude.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think there is upset at the fact that we said we're running Venezuela and we're going to now run it for a few years, he apparently told the Times, you know, or at least more than a year. But what he means by that, you know, is we're going to sort of stand offshore and yell at them until they do it the way we want. And if they don't, we'll send some people in again. You know, with Greenland, you know, you have Germany and England now, you know, offering to create a NATO base there that would protect Greenland. And so you're starting to see, you know, Europe saying, all right, well, there's probably a point we have to protect Greenland more. There's also a lot of people who are realizing that Greenland doesn't really want to be ruled by Denmark and that there's an independence movement in Greenland and that there's a way in which, you know, if you think about freedom and self-determination and democracy, Greenland should be an independent country. You know, there's arguments for things. The how, which is just not caring about your allies, not caring about doing it in a way that brings people along in a way that protects the NATO alliance and also respects the idea of sovereignty and not attacking smaller countries. That, you know, again, is classic Trump idiocy. The how is terrible, and yet you can understand, you know, I think you have to separate it from the what, which there's some sense to be said for, well, maybe Greenland should be independent. Maybe there should be a connection with the United States. Maybe not. I don't know. All the point is he's maddening in this, and he does it over and over again. And so, yeah, I find the way he does things horrific. And yet there is often, you know, he's not. I mean, one of the things that I thought was fascinating about the interview and with the Times, and I know we might talk about it later, is, you know, there's been a lot of talk on the left about how he's senile or losing it or whatever. He talked to them for 4 hours in the White House, and if you listen to the interview, and which I did, there's no senility there. I mean, the guy is sharp, the guy is thoughtful, he's making his points. I disagree with a lot of them, but, you know, he has a worldview, and that worldview is now... you know, largely shared by him, China, and Russia, Putin and Xi, and it's now the worldview of the three most powerful countries in the world. And in many ways, one has to take it seriously.
What's wild to me is that his base, he was voted in so that he could take care of the problems that are happening within this country. And he has been out there doing everything but that. Right. Like, why? I mean, you know, I can understand the removal of Maduro and, you know, he was a terrible leader. But also I don't really see this as being our business. And, you know, I don't think that was our responsibility. It's even more salient with something like Greenland, where there was never any sort of urgent issue there. You know, you were talking about, well, maybe they want independence from Denmark, but This was not an urgent global issue, right? And we have so many issues that are urgent here at home that it's not being taken care of, right? People are upset about, you know, millions of people are about to lose their health insurance because the costs have gone up, right? What is he doing about that? You know, people can't afford to pay rent. What is he going to do about that? Like, there are all these urgent, immediate issues that are impacting Americans. And what's really blasphemous is he's just out and about, like, you know, trying to be this imperialist leader while people back home are suffering. And the issues that motivated them to vote him in the first place are not being addressed.
So,
okay, we're going to pause there because we... Maybe you've noticed. We have a lot more to discuss about this. And we have a lot of letters. And so we'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. And we welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. And we will be back after this break in news with Ray Graff.
And I'm true to the picture of you. I sit down, get to know her, you'll like her. Seemed like the least I could do. Cause when he's charging his chopper up and down your carpet hall, you will think me by contrast quite proper. Never mind I stumble and fall. No, never mind I stumble and fall.
Good morning, welcome back to the Roundtable and remembering Bob Weir on the Roundtable this morning with his music. I just want to take a moment to remember someone else, too. I was very saddened to learn that a dear friend passed away over the weekend, and somebody who was very much a regular part of this program, not to mention a great part of our community, and someone who did so much for the arts and so much for certainly the Berkshires, certainly in Lenox, and also throughout the world. And Tina Packer, the founding artistic director of Shakespeare and Company in Lenox, passed away on Friday evening. She was 87. And I will tell you, I adored this woman. Tina was someone that whenever I would beg her to come on, and she would. And I will say, I just want to say this, that we have a red button, a dump button in the studio, so that when somebody says something bad, I have to press it so it doesn't go out over the air. I think Tina may be the guest I used it the most on over the years. I just became used to it. I became pretty good at it. Yeah, it was like Morse code at some point. But she was a delightful person. She had a charisma. Was so dynamic, and basically we would go on the air and flirt for an hour. And she was just somebody who brought Shakespeare to people, made it accessible, made it interesting. She did this incredible series called Women of Will, which looked at the women in Shakespeare's work that grew into a book that came out about 10 years ago. And it was just new insights into the female characters in Shakespeare. She was funny. She was delightful. That company went through its ups and downs, and she rode the waves. And I just want to say how much we send our love to her family and to the entire Shakespeare and Company family. The artistic director, the current artistic director, Alan Burroughs, has been speaking about her legacy, and my love and condolences to Alan, as well as to Aspen Leader and others throughout that company. That's a very tight-knit company where everybody does a lot of things. And I just want to say, send our condolences and a great thanks to Tina for the beautiful work that she has done over the years. We will very, very much miss her, and think when I would think of a guest that would just be an absolute delight to have in the studio, I would always think of Tina, because I thought, oh, this is you're talking about bull riding, but that's what it was like. You know, it was like you were in the ring for an hour with her, and you didn't know if you were going to come out unscathed or not. And it was so much fun; it was really great. And I just loved her to death, and I thank her so much. And again, our condolences to her family and to all of those in the Shakespeare and Company family and in the arts community in the Berkshires and Hudson Valley, who she certainly had such a great imprint on. So thank you very much. And again, we'll be covering her passing, I know, on the news as well. But I wanted to mention that Tina Packer passed away over this weekend at the age of 87. All right. Now, let's go to a lot of letters that we got on what we were talking about earlier. And that is what's happening in Iran. Jonathan says it's a moral failure to ask that we examine, quote, the successes and benefits of Trump's neo-imperialism.
if I'm remembering the phrase that was just used correctly, imperialism of any stripe, especially when carried out by a democracy, is wrong. It's the same way that slavery and genocide is a non-debatable wrong. Yes, it's possible to examine the successes and benefits of genocide and imperialism, but doing so is itself a moral failure. It represents a complicity and acceptance that is not okay. The appropriate response is to decry it. We are called on to resist. And in a democracy where we do still have freedoms to speak and to vote, the moral response is to change it. That from Jonathan. We go to Paul. What qualifies Russia as a world power? It has the economic power of Italy. Sure, Russia has enough atomic weapons to bring the world to its knees. A gun to the world's head makes Russia a criminal, not a world power. Jocelyn says, I kind of can't believe what I'm hearing from my radio speaker this morning, from the panelist who is single-handedly justifying and rationalizing Trump's actions while simultaneously telling the other panelist in oh-so-soft terms that they are the ones who aren't thinking clearly or doing their homework. That is hogwash. Trump's foreign policy is simply based on his neurotic need for power obtained solely through violence and chaos. Guess who pays for that? People pay for that with their lives. Then we go to Linda. Haven't we learned yet that everything Trump does is related to money and himself and his own advancements? Everything he does relates to that and nothing else, except, as was mentioned, changing the focus of the news when it doesn't suit him. John writes, I would like to disagree with Roger, who said he was on the radio stating his views and is not afraid for his liberty, i.e. being arrested. If he was a retired military member, such as myself or Captain Mark Kelly, that perhaps would not be the case, says John. Then, I promise I'll give you a chance to respond, Roger. Lorraine says, some panelists between current events and historical events suggest it is not ridiculous to think we are on a track that could end in repression and violence similar to what we are seeing in Iran. The irony is that the U.S. government is considering supporting protesters in Iran while government-sanctioned armed mass thugs roam our streets, drag people out of their cars and homes, and increasingly shoot them with no checks on their behavior and apparently no accountability. Glad WAMC brings on panelists who are not always in agreement on all issues. Sociopaths are also capable of sounding thoughtful, reasonable, sane. Doesn't mean they are not also dangerously insane. Then we go to Beth. I heard John Bolton interviewed on the BBC this weekend. Among other things, he said, we give Trump way too much credit if we think he has a coherent foreign policy. Then Doug writes, unlike the Caribbean, the Persian Gulf is a tight, exposed place to bring a carrier battle group within range of weapons that Venezuela doesn't have. Iran likely has the capability to do serious damage to U.S. assets. Iranian military and Revolutionary Guard are much more capable than Venezuela's military. Finally, what is the day after plan for Iran? We don't seem to have a clear one in Venezuela. Norma says the U.S. destroyed the economy of Venezuela and Iran with their sanctions because they want their oil. The West talks about democracy and human rights but supports the genocide of the Palestinian people. That is total hypocrisy. Then we go to this one more here before we take a break, just in the letters. Sherry says, I feel as though Trump is playing a game of Monopoly without regard for people and countless around the world. Apparently, his America First propaganda was flushed and he just wanted power. How is no one able to stop this madman? Are there no laws in place to remove him before it is too late? And that from Sherry. Who would like to respond first?
I think people are right. There is no coherent foreign policy. He's just doing whatever he wants to do because he likes being the strong man. And I think that, you know, I'll go back to what I said. And I can't imagine how I read half the New York Times interview, right? And it was like coherent, not really. A simple sentence, he can't put one together. I mean, these are the things that I look for in a leader, right? Yeah. Two very, very simple things. And he is not it, and he hasn't been able to do it. The fact of the matter that he is so willing to invade another country's sovereignty without any regard to the people, to the fact that Venezuela didn't send a bomb over. They didn't carpet bomb Nevada or anything like that. There was no instigation. The fact that he is willing to do that and there are people saying, cheering him on despite his America First rhetoric, I just don't get it. And I think, again, and I will go back to this every single time, all of this is a distraction to keep us from thinking about who this man really is and whether or not he should be in the White House. We all know that he shouldn't be there. But the fact that the matter is that he engaged in some with Jeffrey Epstein in some really disturbing behavior.
Yeah. And the these measures to distract run the risk of pulling us into greater danger. Right.
That's for sure.
It's just not it doesn't make any sense other than to save his own ass.
to say what?
To save his own ass.
Right. Oh, and you didn't write the
person. Well, that's what it is. Yeah.
That wouldn't
even make Tina blush.
Right.
I understand what you're saying, Libby, but I also wonder if what you just said is that, you know, no one believes that. Well, a year ago, they voted for him, right?
Yeah.
And again, like,
right.
And also on about the Epstein thing, like, there was nothing there now. There's nothing there now that wasn't there
before
then.
Right.
And,
except millions of documents that people can now read.
Okay, but it's not going to change anybody's mind.
Except, okay, yes, he'll have his 30%. He'll always have his 30%. The fact that local elections across the country in swing areas went blue portends what's going to happen next November,
right.
This coming November in 2026, a blue wave where we'll hopefully take over the House and maybe take back the Senate. Because
from your mouth
some
to God's ears.
Huh? Right. But look, I ran a race up in the 5th JD in New York State, which is incredibly red. It's not Warren. It's Onondaga, Oneida, Herkimer, Oswego, Jefferson, Lewis. Incredibly red, right? People were so disgusted that we elected three Democrats there, which has never been done before. Mm-hmm. The last time a Democrat had been elected was years and years and years ago. Onondaga County Legislature flipped to blue. Dutchess County flipped blue.
Mm-hmm.
And that is really something because it is a hotbed of Republicanism. It always has been. As a juxtaposition to the people across the river in Ulster, right? And so I think that, yes, he'll always have his 30%, but there are the folks that are NOPs. They're not enrolled in a party that are saying, I didn't sign up for this, right? I signed up for America First.
Mm-hmm.
I signed up for a better economy. I signed up for inflation being lowered and my heat bills being lowered, and that's not happening. I signed up for gas being less, and now, so magically, it's less than $3 a gallon.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to stay there. It's just going to keep going up.
Yeah, and all these resources are being sent abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's just way too many comments to answer them all.
You can try.
I'll try. No, I won't. You know,
Do you want me to forward them to you? No,
yeah, please. Oh, that's to make my day. There was one about former military not being given free speech. I don't know what that's about. I mean, former military personnel have the same free speech rights as anyone else.
Isn't that the Mark Kelly issue?
Well, no, but that's not a free speech rights. I mean, they're taking a security detail away. I mean, that's a different story.
Oh, but they want to shut him
but
up.
But it's what he said about...
Yeah, but
about following orders, which Mark Kelly refers to as a free speech issue.
That's yeah, but I mean, he's still allowed to say what he is. He's just going to lose he's going to lose certain privileges.
But he shouldn't have to. He shouldn't be losing any of those privileges.
I agree with you.
Because
he
spoke out against.
So this is another issue: the Trump weaponization of the Justice Department, mm-hmm. and we can come to what he's doing to Jerome Powell, is one of the absolute travesties and worst things he's doing, and one of the more dangerous things. That said, for the most part, our legal system is holding up. I mean, there are exceptions, and the Trump judges are. I mean, I saw the statistic the other day that I don't know the exact numbers, so if someone has it, they can tell me. But you know, in 600 cases, the Trump judges have voted with Trump. With 12, they voted against him, and something like that. It was sort of ridiculous. I think largely our legal system so far is holding up. It won't hold on forever, which is why the midterm elections and then in 3 years the presidential elections are so important. And I think Libby's right. There is a widespread sense amongst not only people like us, but people who voted for Trump or were sympathetic to Trump, that on affordability issues, on the enforcement, the over enforcement of ICE, which is just an absolute travesty and disaster, and certain other issues, he has not delivered, and he's gone way beyond what people expected, and again, people are upset with it. So I think there's a good chance that there will be a correction in the midterms. I hope. And hopefully in 3 years there'll be a bigger correction if the Democrats can nominate someone who can actually speak to the people and win.
Let's see. Three quick letters and then we'll move on to other topics. From Trish, hang in there, Roger. You're the only panelist making any sense this morning. Also, I love the United States and am appalled by most of President Trump's actions and behaviors. I commend Roger for his comment that most of the world, save for ourselves and our allies, find the idea that our country is a benevolent force for good in the world laughable. At least since the fall of the Soviet Union, our actions have mostly resulted in turmoil in the less stable parts of the world. And finally, go to Marion, who said, we can get more from Greenland as their friend and ally than as their invader. Mm-hmm. Greenland likely prefers democracy over the rule of a dictator. And if we could act like a democracy rather than a dictatorship, we can have favorable status for mining bases, et cetera, while NATO protects them from hostile powers. That from Marion. All right. Let's move on and go to other subjects that we want to talk about this morning. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the other big story is that federal prosecutors have opened an investigation into Fed Chair Jerome Powell. The investigation, which is said to center on renovations of the Federal Reserve's headquarters in Washington, is an escalation of the president's long-running pressure campaign on Jerome Powell. The U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C. has opened a criminal investigation into Powell, the Federal Reserve chair, over the central bank's renovation of its Washington headquarters and whether Mr. Powell lied to Congress about the scope of the project, according to officials briefed on the situation. It's hard not to comment on a story like this,
but it's that East Wing thing, isn't it?
The ballroom, right. But it's different.
Yeah, because he's doing it, and and he's spending massive amounts of taxpayer money, as well as supposedly private money, on this, adding a third floor, or he wants to add another floor to the West Wing or something like
that. It's still all rubble right now, right?
Yeah. Right. And then you have him, you know, getting his knickers in a twist about Jerome Powell not wanting to ruin the economy. Well, isn't that too bad?
The inquiry, which includes an analysis of Mr. Powell's public statements and an examination of spending records, was approved in November by Jeanine Pirro, a longtime ally of President Trump, who was appointed to run the office last year. The investigation is a remarkable escalation in Mr. Trump's long-running pressure campaign on Mr. Powell, whom the president has continually attacked for resisting his demands to slash interest rates significantly. The president has threatened to fire the Fed chair, even though he nominated Mr. Powell for the position in 2017, and raised the prospect of a lawsuit against him related to the $2.5 billion renovation, citing incompetence. Mr. Trump told the New York Times in an interview last week that he had decided on who he wants to replace Mr. Powell as Fed chair. He is expected to soon announce his decision. Kevin Hassett, Mr. Trump's top economic advisor, is a front runner for the top job. While Mr. Powell's term as chair ends in May, his term as a governor runs through January 2028. Mr. Powell has not disclosed whether he plans to stay on at the central bank beyond this year. So this is a guy that we know the president doesn't like, and now another action is being taken.
Oh, there's some classic dictator moves, right? Like you just replace the people who are not doing what you want them to, and he's looking for whatever viable reason he can shore up. And in this case, it's bonkers. I mean, it's like, okay, we're going to fixate on the renovation of this building. And as you said, they'll be like, oh, what other major renovation projects going on right now? Right. So this is another effort to seize control, to fill offices with people who are, you know, willing to do what he wants.
Those are called lackeys.
Yeah. Without any regard for the actual consequences of what these actions would mean when carried out.
I mean, he is clearly a wannabe tyrant. Luckily, we have a legal system that resists it. We don't have much of a Congress, but we hope that some of them are starting to wake up. There's some signs that they will, even some of the Republicans, although that's something I've been hoping for 9 years, and it hasn't happened. What he wants to do is intimidate everybody into simply allowing him to do whatever he wants. And that's classic tyrannical behavior. Luckily, we live in a country in which you have mayors and police chiefs and other people who are standing up to him and saying no. And I give those people an enormous amount of credit. And I think we should support them through words, actions, protests, civil disobedience, and everything in our power to continue to support public officials, public intellectuals, public people who are standing up to what's clearly an attempt to acquire a kind of almost absolute tyrannical powers in this country.
We're going to take a break, but as the New York Times states, and continuing in the article, starting an investigation is one matter, presenting sufficient evidence to secure an indictment from a grand jury or making it stick is quite another.
Right. They couldn't make it stick against James
Comey. So
we'll
talk about all of that when we come back right after this.
Don't worry about me. No, no, don't worry about me, no. And I'm in no hurry.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Roger Berkowitz, Libby Post, and Catherine Tan with us. And we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We were talking just a moment ago about Jerome Powell, and we were talking about Trump's investigation and wanting the investigation into Powell from the inquiry to the Fed chair. Anybody else want to say anything else about that?
The only thing I'll say is that I saw that Tom Tillis announced, who's a Republican who's retiring, which, again, I wish these Republicans who oppose Trump wouldn't retire but would actually stand up and run against his record, but they seem unable and unwilling to do that. But he did announce that he would oppose any confirmation of any nominee for the Fed, including any coming chair vacancy, because of these subpoenas. And this is just another chink in the armor here. You know, I mean, it's clear that there are people in the Senate and the House who are starting to say enough's enough. And that is, and we have to look, you don't have to love Tom Tillis, but you have to start giving encouragement to these public figures, and I think that's something we all need to do.
All right, let's move on to other topics for this Monday morning and things that are going on and continue to go on. I do want to give us a bit of an update of what is happening in Minnesota. Of course, the ICE shooting on Wednesday is still reverberating and very much in the news. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem remained adamant that Renee Good was responsible for her own death, as Democrats insisted on a full investigation before drawing conclusions. In an interview with Fox News' Sunday Morning Futures, Homeland Security, is that the name of that show now? Okay. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said the administration will send more officers to Minneapolis on Sunday and Monday. There will be hundreds more in order to allow our ICE and our former Border Patrol individuals that are working in Minneapolis to do so safely, Noem said. The Department of Homeland Security said last week that the crackdown in Minnesota would involve 2,000 federal agents and officers, calling it the agency's largest immigration enforcement operation ever. Protests have continued throughout the weekend. Demonstrators gathered across the country to protest immigration and customs enforcement and the killing of Renee Good, a 37-year-old mother of three. If any of you were out and about this weekend on Saturday, no matter what town, village, city you happened to drive through, there were protests, and I would say very large protests throughout most municipalities that people were really taking to the streets. Trump officials remained adamant Sunday that Good was responsible for her own death, while Democrats insisted the investigation including local law enforcement, must be completed before drawing any conclusions. Tensions over the facts of the incident grew as the FBI, which has taken over the investigation, continued to block Minnesota officials from participating in the inquiry, forcing the local authorities to conduct their own review. Speaking to CNN's State of the Union, Noem said that Good was to blame for the shooting, even though an official investigation into the shooting has not been completed, and his video evidence raised several questions about the administration's assessment of what happened. That from the Washington Post.
You know, I just want to say I hate smartphones, but thank God we have them because, you know, we have seen this horrific murder on so many different camera phones and from different angles.
Ring and doorbells and the like.
Exactly. And I think, you know, I think it's outrageous that they're trying to gaslight us out of seeing what we saw, right? Because clearly this is a woman who was trying to follow orders. She was unarmed. You know, she wasn't the one, you know, that was carrying guns,
right?
So she posed really no threat to these people. And okay, so we know that, you know, we know that the United States is a racist place and a lot of people with authority will use excessive force and will murder people of color more so than, encounters with white citizens. And in this case, what I think, you know, we've reached a really interesting place culturally and politically in which you have, you know, this white woman who is a mother, right? And this is a character that I'm not saying she is, but I'm saying generally this is a population that is often lifted by the Republican Party, right? And used as a moral symbol. And here we have a white mother murdered in her car, and the party is quickly saying, no, she's a terrorist. And I'm really interested in seeing how his supporters and Republicans are going to deal with this, right? It's going to require quite a bit of backbending and twisting in order to justify this at all, because we see those camera footages, right? We saw what happened. This is something that could have been entirely avoided. And it highlights the problem with having ICE agents all over these cities, right? They are not here to protect citizens. And we know that there are just too many agents out and they're not doing what they're supposed to do. Trump was saying that we need these ICE agents out looking for people, especially violent criminals, mm-hmm. people who have a record. But most of the people that they are picking up are not violent criminals, right? These are regular people, and they're arresting people in front of courthouses, people who are trying to get their green cards, people who are doing the things that they're supposed to do, that they've been told they're supposed to do in order to have legal documentation in this country. And all this is doing is discouraging people and driving them underground, which is incredibly dangerous.
Well, you know, I always think that if you want to stop a car, clearly, mm-hmm. just shoot out its tires.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
Just shoot the tires. The car won't be able to go anywhere. Yeah. Then you can deal with whoever the person was. This guy, the woman was saying, no, not to worry, you know, bye. I mean, there was something that she said that dismissed it all and just was just driving away. And he is so fragile that a car going towards him 5 miles an hour is such a threat. And then you have Kristi Noem, right?
Yeah.
His boss.
Yeah.
Getting up and saying, one of ours, all of yours, which came from Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these people are fascists. They are Nazis. Mm-hmm. And they want this country to be straight, white, and Christian.
Mm-hmm.
This woman, not that the guy who shot her knew.
Yeah.
This is a lesbian.
She's a lesbian. Yeah.
She's a lesbian. She's got kids.
Mm-hmm.
She was a well-meaning, mm-hmm. functional person, mm-hmm. adding to her community.
Right. But they see American citizens as the enemy.
That's right. They do.
Yeah.
They see anybody who speaks up against them as the enemy. And, you know, a lot of these folks that they're arresting, or some of these folks that they're arresting, are U.S. citizens.
Mm-hmm.
And they're doing it just based on the color of their skin. And that's it. You know, those of us who are white, we have a lot of privilege in this situation because they're not coming at us immediately.
Well, she was white, but yeah.
No, but
I know,
that's
she was
the point.
In that
like
car, you know, I mean, we're not going to walk out of here, right? There are three white people in this room, and you're Asian,
mm-hmm.
right? We can walk, all four of us can walk out of here, and who would be targeted? You would be targeted, Asian woman, because you look different.
Yeah, and with this case, what it shows us is, yes, I mean, absolutely, white privilege is still definitely a thing in this country. But it's also showing us that it's not going to protect you forever, right?
No.
Like, especially when you have an authoritarian, you know, dictator running around seeing anyone who's exercising freedom of speech as a terrorist.
Right. I mean, this is what happened in Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
You know, first we had to wear yellow stars. Then we got marched to the camps. Then we were killed. I mean, and the same thing is happening here, just not on larger scale, as a larger scale. But you have these armed thugs. They're not trained.
No.
They don't know what they're doing. They get a $50,000 or $100,000 signing bonus. I mean, come on. And then everyone else is talking about, I can't pay for food.
Yeah.
Right? So it's just a total disconnect from the reality of what it is to be an American right now.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I agree here most with what's been said. You know, I'll just point out that Minneapolis obviously has a history in the last 7 or 8 years with the George Floyd protests.
Right.
They brought in a police chief from New York, Brian O'Hara, who I heard interviewed for a while this morning. And, you know, he actually, I think a few hours or a day before this shooting, predicted that this was going to happen and was, you know, called for both calm by the protesters, but also criticized pretty heavily the tactics of the federal police, federal ICE agents and others, and contrasted how local police have been responding with restraint and community mm-hmm. safety in mind mm-hmm. with the approach of ICE. And, you know, I mean, the background here, of course, is that the main reason that the president has sent all these ICE agents into Minneapolis right now, or at least ostensibly, right, is this fraud investigation around welfare and or social, I forget exactly what, social services, amongst in which a number of Somali citizens were involved. And yet, you know, the demonization of the Somali population, of Somalia as a country, the demonization of Minneapolis, you know, while I think there's a and there's so there's clearly a racial component to this, right? That's that's undeniable. But I think even more important than that is the political point. He's going, you know, you're not seeing him go into conservative cities or conservative areas with these kind of force. He's going into liberal cities with these forces as a way of fomenting fear and chaos. And it's an attempt to try and create rebellion, to try and create, he wants to create, you know, what happened in, you know, in Portland and other places, and then have to bring in the army or bring in the National Guard. And so, you know, it is a very tense situation. And what I would say is right now, what you're seeing is lots of decentralized local protest groups with whistles and cameras and other things. And I think that's great. But what we really need are trained civil disobedience people who know how to nonviolently protest, how to, you know, break the law if you need to, but do so in a peaceful way that accords with civility, civil disobedience. And the problem is that a lot of these people, and I have great respect, you know, from what I can tell for Renee Good, I think she was trying to do her best, but people who are not trained right now and going and confronting militarized, armed forces in with untrained civilians who don't know what they're doing is going to lead to danger. It's going to lead to people getting killed. And I think we need a national civil disobedience movement that actually begins to organize people in ways that will be quite more effective than it's currently at working.
You know, you're right, and I remember those civil disobedience trainings. You know, we did a big one for the March on Washington in 1987 and for lesbian and gay rights and, you know, Martin Luther King. And the problem is that we can be trained all we want. They're going to see us as a threat and shoot us anyway. And so, you know, but the whole fraud thing, I mean, you know, he's going after the Somalis for this fraud, yet he's pardoned all these white people who have defrauded the government and defrauded taxpayers out of billions of dollars.
In one of the southern, a big fraud in one of the southern states too.
And they're like, oh, we don't care.
Well, they're picking and choosing which issues to highlight and cutting to demonize.
They're cutting funds to to five blue states.
Yeah.
Not everybody, and that's illegal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's next.
All right. We'll take a break. Next, we'll take a break and then we'll be back and we'll finish up the show and have some remaining comments from our group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. We'll return right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Just a few minutes before we end the roundtable panel and go into our third hour, I did want to mention, because we've all alluded to it at some point, this morning, but the president gave a rather unprecedented interview with the New York Times last week. Over 2 hours in length, you, as Roger noted earlier, you can listen to it.
On the Daily. The Daily has a great hour-long
version
of it.
There is a full transcript out from the New York Times. 23,000 words were spoken. Hopefully AI had to count that and not a human being. A nearly two-hour interview, and one that was really certainly far-ranging. But it's almost like, I don't know how you all felt about it, but it seemed like it was too much news. There was just so much that you could take from it and make a story out of, and I think that probably is going to be the case for a while. For example, one, President Trump said in an interview that he believes civil rights era protections resulted in white people being very badly treated. His strongest indication that the concept of reverse discrimination is driving his aggressive crusade against diversity policies. In the interview, he echoed grievances amplified by Vice President J.D. Vance and other top officials who in recent weeks have urged white men to file federal complaints with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. When asked whether protections that began in the 60s, spurred by the passage of the Civil Rights Act, had resulted in discrimination against white men, President Trump said he believed a lot of people were very badly treated. Some of this was new, some of this was not, and so there's a lot there, but some of it we have heard before. Let's see. I want to, when you listen to it, there are four journalists, and it is a spirited conversation, but it doesn't. This is a president, this is noted in a couple of opinion pieces. This is a president who hates the media and loves the media. I hate the media, by the way. New York Times journalist, welcome to my office.
Right.
Let's spend a couple hours and talk to each other.
Right, because I want you to say exactly what I say, and I want you to report it exactly as I want it reported. So
any initial thoughts of looking at the...
You know, I read half of it this morning, and, you know, everything's great. Everything's big. Everything's, you know... We're going to take over. We're going to make the world right for white people. I mean, it's just, it's his inability, like I said before, to speak in a complete sentence and to really have a thought that starts here, has a middle, and ends there.
Right. Just because he has stamina, it
right.
doesn't mean
right. Just because he can talk for 2 hours doesn't
coherence,
mean he's making
yeah.
any sense.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, everybody around him will just prop him up and make excuses. And... I don't watch the news for a reason, because I don't want to see them. I'll read the news, and I read it, but I'm glad they did this, because any thinking person who would read the transcript would realize we're not dealing with a rocket scientist.
Yeah, and this is, you know, they're releasing the transcript as is. There's no selective quotes or anything
right.
like that. So I think there is a real value in having this out there, right, for people to read for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if you're a diehard Trump supporter, I don't know if you would be, you know, I don't know if this would cause any doubt or uncertainty.
Yeah,
it's just more of the same talking points that we're familiar with.
The first headline that came out of this, and to me, after reading the whole thing, this does seem to be the big one, if you will, is that he said that he is constrained only by his own morality. Brushing aside international law and other checks and his ability to use military might to strike, invade, or coerce nations around the world, he made clear that he would be the arbiter of any limits to his authorities, not international law or treaties.
Yeah. So first, I got a couple things to say. One is, first, kudos to the New York Times. I mean, Times has been sued by him for billions of dollars. He criticizes them constantly. The willingness of the Times to go in and do this with him, I think, is a great service to the country. Two, you know, at least from my own point of view, I was fairly, I have been listening to the people saying he's losing it, he's mentally unfit and things like that, and I was interested to see. This was a 4.5 hour conversation. A bunch of it was off the record, so 2 hours was on the record. I think it's clear if you actually listen to it, the parts that are on recording, this man is not losing it. And, you know, I think that's at least, to me, that was a valuable thing to know. I think it's a mistake to people to keep saying that. And I think it will only be counterproductive. Third, you know, whereas most of when we hear him talk is through tweets and through stupid sound bites and through long-winded speeches where no one questions him, here was a opportunity for people to question him, push back against him. I mean, one of the most revealing parts was when, you know, they talked about the shooting of Renee Good, where he said, well, the video says one thing, and they say, oh, no, and they took out a computer and they watched it together frame by frame, and you heard his voice as he was trying to defend what he was saying. And the reporters said, look, it did seem like he was shaken a little bit by having to watch the video that way. And seeing him have to confront critics in that way, I think, was extraordinary. You know,
less than a minute, but go ahead.
The overarching takeaway for me is that we have a president who is complete candor in his power and authoritarian ideas and has absolutely no hypocrisy. And I wish we had more hypocrisy. I wrote about this weekend, but basically we need hypocrisy in the sense that we need a president who at least gives lip service to certain values and certain morality. And the idea that I can do whatever I want, I can do it in foreign affairs, I can do it in domestic affairs, and there's no limits on me except my own moral conscience. That's the kind of candor without hypocrisy. There's a reason that's saying, you know, that hypocrisy is the compliment vice pays to virtue. There's a use for hypocrisy, and this president has none of it, and it reminds us that politics needs some hypocrisy.
Roger Berkowitz, Libby Post, Catherine Tan, we're out of time. I thank you all so much for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thank
you all.
More
show will continue after this short break.